Hi, I'm Amanda Rabideau, and welcome to CoreLogic's Innovation in Housing podcast. Today, we continue our discussion about artificial intelligence with Rob Carpenter and Aaron Wepler. So before we were talking about different industries' usage of AI in the evolution, what about the everyday person, the consumer? What is public sentiment on this?
I think it's evolving. And why I say it's evolving, I don't know that too many people push back on telling Alexa to turn lights on in their house or controlling their thermostat from an airplane, but at the same time forgetting to do that and leaving your AC at 72 and you have a provision in your Nest that says, no, it should be at 76. So it's building in a lot of fail-safes that are ultimately improving the quality of life. And it's not the learning curve to do this is, you know, normal, meaning it's much easier to say something than to type something. So we're playing to our strengths. If, you know, our strength is want more, do less.
I think there's a lot of fear, too. I hear
Let's talk about the
almost
fear.
Every day from somebody about Alexa or Google Assistant or Siri, the fear that they're collecting data about you because it's necessary. They need that data to train these algorithms or these tools. And with everything that's gone on with Facebook this year and others, people are pretty nervous about that. I'm not sure they're willing to walk away from the benefits, but there's a lot of concern. So I think what that really means is that it's incumbent on the any industry that's playing with this technology to be transparent, to be really, really transparent about what you're using it for and how it's functioning. And if you, I think if you do that, that's the kind of thing that the community can get behind it and get comfortable with.
It goes back to the weak, narrow AI use cases from like your car driving itself. Like if you just look at where cars driving themselves is going, that doesn't really get interesting until cars can start talking to one another. Because right
it's like
now,
Knight Rider come to life.
Yeah. So
I guess that's talking to the person.
No. Well, think of it this way. We are anyone who has an autonomous vehicle knows that the accuracy of that autonomous vehicle is subject to how well the roads are painted. No way around it. The only way to improve it is to measure its distance to other things around it, and those other things around it have to communicate via a digital signal, whether that's the road. Whether that's the guardrails, digital insertion, I mean, it has to transmit information over a network.
Right.
So think about it this way. Once you put all this information out on the network, which ultimately drives a better autonomous experience, what if the network gets hacked? So the degree at which AI is effective opens us up for other things that aren't even implicitly the machine learning. It's human beings taking advantage of everything being a machine.
Yeah, so how do we address that?
Well, there's a lot of conversations about security around these things. Now, I haven't heard a bunch yet about security around AI in particular. I suspect that's coming as AI moves into more critical decision-making roles. So nobody cares if they hack, you know, Amazon's recommendation engine, right? And so, and, you know, I'm seeing, you know, diapers instead of snow shovels, whatever. I mean, that because it's not critical.
Right,
but if
right.
you start looking at credit decisions or, you know, and this is coming, medicine recommendations, right? Prescriptions. So that's absolutely coming, that I'm going to take your, the attributes of your diagnosis from your doctor and the drugs you're currently taking, and I'm going to make some recommendations based on that. Somebody hacks that, and that could get ugly real quick.
But the interesting point to that is because of this fear mentality around the things we don't understand, let's say we take the example where somebody is prescribed medicine by a program like IBM Watson, right? And Watson is making recommendations on behalf of a hospital of what medicines to take. And in 99.2% of the cases, it improves the process, the health, the overall mm-hmm. experience for the hospital and the patient. But right. in 0.8%, which is 70% better than it is today, but in 0.8% of the cases, it causes serious harm. Because a person is not involved, what are the decisions we make at that point? And it's no different with a Tesla car crashing.
Who's held accountable?
Exactly. But the overall safety ratings of autonomous vehicles are measured to be far superior to the alternative of someone driving a car manually. But do we have the
legal liability rules?
Exactly.
And this has always been my prediction on autonomous driving, that the thing that's going to retard the development of it is the lack of clear liability laws. You know, who
definitely.
So the insurance companies have known for a long time this was coming, and by long time, I mean, let's say 5 years, mm-hmm. and that car insurance was going to go to zero or near zero in the not too distant future.
Which is why they all want to become transportation organizations, mm-hmm. not just insurers.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so they see it coming and are moving against it. But how do you solve it? Is it the author of the software? Is it the car company? Is there a general pool that everybody pays into, and there are just fixed payments that we accept as a society that the overall improvement is worth moving forward? Or maybe if you're an automobile company, you know, a Tesla or Ford, and that you get some aggregate number at the end of a year, and you pay out against to keep you incentive. You know, the whole point of tort law is to keep you incentivized to do the right thing.
Right.
And so you still want those incentives, but you don't want it to turn into, the evil empire, killed my niece or my daughter and, $100 million.
Shuts it down.
Unless it was a known problem and they didn't correct it, and then there were some deaths, and then they ignored
right.
it. You know, that's legitimate. But there needs to be a way to assign liability in all industries. Like, how do you deal with that once it becomes pervasive?
I guess my point's a little more higher level than that, because that's obviously a realistic application of it. But is this the first time that we hold something to the absolute? It has to be good in 100% of the use cases because we don't understand it or we don't trust it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I can tell you, without a doubt, that software is without flaw. The only flaws software has is because humans write it. It just does what it's told to do.
Mm-hmm.
And how long does that paradigm hold up before it starts informing itself of what it's...
Self-writing software.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So I just deconstructed the absolution that I just stated.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, and then that's where you have people like Elon Musk talking about AI needs to be regulated, because I don't think anybody's made a breakthrough that they can't walk back from. But it's at what point does it hit critical mass where it goes so fast and decisions right. are being made on the fly because the learning is happening so quickly that it might be hard to walk back?
Right.
Is there any legislation that's currently being made right now?
I think it's so far beyond
their ability to actually write it.
Legislature's ability to understand what's happening. I think people are talking, mm-hmm. but it's not the most tech savvy group to start with. But they get advice and so on from inside and outside the industry. I don't think until there's an event we're going to see much.
Mm-hmm.
Then it could go the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at legislation though. Autonomous cars have done a lot to drive that conversation with AI forward, because
right.
we started with something like a Tesla being able to autopilot itself.
Right.
And then when somebody said autopilot, people got very concerned very quickly. So then we started categorizing it as level one, which means cruise control. Level two, meaning cruise control steering assist. Level three, meaning fully autonomous with a steering wheel. Level four being fully autonomous, no steering wheel. And it wasn't until we came out with the idea that we could start to quantify how we structured the idea. So it's got to be an open dialogue for the next 10 years until it gets to some place that is well-formed. And at the rate we're at, it's not going to be well-formed for a while. And the worst thing we can do is introduce legislation too early to never let it become what it could potentially be.
Or even legislation that is written with, let's call it stage four, tier four, however you want to look at the different stages that you just described. And if you have all those different stages, you don't want to legislate to the extreme. You need different rules for each of those different stages because it's not the same scenario.
Correct.
And if you only legislate towards the most extreme, then you have the more rigid rules and we can't make the progress that we need.
And then you insert capitalism into the conversation, which says, if I sell a BMW, I'm selling a driving experience. What do you mean? I will always have a steering wheel. Versus like Google's building a car that doesn't have a steering wheel because it's the safest way.
Right.
So it just depends on how you market your business and letting governance drive capitalism and capitalism drive governance.
Well, and I think then that takes us down a rabbit hole around lobbying groups and things like that, which maybe is outside of the scope of artificial intelligence. But still, the regulation and the legislature around it is certainly something that's top of mind for several people.
You can see it coming, though. Let's take it back to the housing industry. Mm-hmm. You can see models emerging. Some have been around for a few years where there is no human underwriter anymore, that it's all algorithm. And it's making all the decisions. They say, we've run analytics and this is what we want, and it just runs. You can see that coming.
How far away is that?
I think it's, let's just take the housing, the mortgage industry for lending. I think it's pretty far away, meaning not in the next 3 years or, maybe within 15, mm-hmm. somewhere between 3 and 15 years it could be here. The issue is that just the way the market's structured. It's this long supply chain. We go all the way from, mm-hmm. The real estate agent and a loan officer, works for an originator and sells to somebody else, ends up on the capital markets. There's a lot of structure in there, and whatever happens has to be able to fit inside that structure. You need a lot more people involved to get it done. Whereas if I'm doing personal lending with my own capital or a bunch of investors' capital, mm-hmm. I don't have to deal with anybody else. And so I can be really innovative. It could be that's where the transformation actually comes from. It comes from outside. People find it easier to do that kind of deal, lending than for a home than going through the traditional channels that exist today.
And when you ask how far, I think you have to decouple capability from adoption.
Okay. Well, then let's decouple those. How far from capability are we there today versus how far from adoption?
I think for a significant portion of the transactions today, we're easily there. There's a little bit of it going on already. I mean, Fannie and Freddie each have their own automated underwriting engine. So they've poured over millions and millions of loans, and they've built out secret, probably not so secret, but opaque boxes that you call and hand information, and they come back and say, we'll buy or we won't buy, and here if you do these things. So there's a little bit of that going on, but there's still humans involved to assess the things that actually flow up into those data sets that get sent in. But I think technology is easily there for maybe 60% of the really, really vanilla loans.
What's going to be interesting is deconstructing the process to be at an immature form to build it to be the best process at a mature form.
Right.
Because we come back to...
Let's go break that down a little bit. So what do you mean by that?
So part of transformation is really taking something that is well known and well understood and then... I don't know if this is the best way to describe it, but you refactor it. But when you do refactoring, you improve certain things and other things get worse. They get worse because they need feedback on how they should progress. So you have a well-suited process today. Well-suited because everybody has a predictable notion of how long it should take and what the experience is going to be like, even if it's painful. when you introduce change, human beings historically don't like it because they don't understand it.
Right.
Because when things don't go right, they don't know what pattern to follow to troubleshoot.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at how these models work, they improve over time because what happens is you have a happy path and then things execute through that happy path using new algorithms, new machine learning models, simulations that are in line with what we determine the output should look like. But then you have a lot of things that fall out, and then all of a sudden you have a large exception team that uses what falls out to build that into the logic that is part of the happy path. So the happy path starts small. The exception path starts large. Having the buy-in from your internal stakeholders and from your customers is very difficult because you're not presenting the end solution. Mm. You're evolving it.
So to Aaron's point, if you're an enterprise, and let's say with lending, and you want to run the happy path, these are these vanilla loans I was talking about. Very few complexities to it. Maybe let's just lay it out. Maybe it's a married couple. One of the spouses stay at home. One works for a big corporation, been there 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
We can pull their W-2s and their payroll information directly. Really high credit scores, a whole bit, right? Everything looks good, very simple, not much to it. So
okay.
You could build really interesting processes around that that would be highly streamlined. Today, they have to live inside of a more complex process that handles all the other kinds of borrower things that come up. And so their experience isn't particularly great. What you see starting to happen is, why doesn't somebody just go take those lenders out and say, if you're one of these, I mean, and this is to some extent what SoFi was doing and some others. If you're one of these kinds of people,
mm-hmm.
come borrow from me and your experience will be awesome. And so they're going to end up, because the mainline lenders have to handle such a broad swath of products and borrowers, they're going to get adversely selected over time if they don't get on this and solve for the easy ones and give them a quick path. You know, maybe you can make the case that that's what Quicken was doing with Rocket Mortgage, was just a few people. We'll get them over here, not everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going to make sure we're not getting adversely selected, right? Or maybe we're even forcing everybody else to adversely select. We'll take the easy loans that have very low costs, that move very fast, and we're going to reward the borrower with a better experience. Mm-hmm. I think that's the model, that the people will begin to segment and
that sounds
drive
like bias
segment.
Again, though, right?
Well, you got to be careful, of course,
yeah.
But having somebody with very simple terms and lending to them, I think, is perfectly fine within a set of constraints.
Got it.
Happens in lots of industries that are highly regulated. That I'm only going to lend to this kind of person. You're not forced to take on self-employed borrowers. I mean, nobody was serving them for a while inside the mainline market. They were too complex. Nobody could figure out how to get the loans sold without too much work. And they were very expensive to execute,
mm-hmm.
so they just weren't getting done effectively for a while. So why isn't somebody popping up, putting in a really slick AI-based platform, consumer-directed transaction, driving at those people, say, answer these 10 questions, and if I get the right set of answers, I'll take you as a customer. And I'm, the Fannie Mae reports the average cost of origination is somewhere north of $8,000.
Oh, wow. And that's because of all the regulation
yes,
and security?
Significantly higher than it was prior to the meltdown, where it was like $5,000 or so. And it's all regulatory related. Not the regulations themselves, but just fear that leads to check the checker kinds of stuff. But if I can build a streamlined platform, maybe I can share some of that $8,000 that I'm going to save directly with that consumer and make it really interesting.
If you build great things, users will conform.
Give me an example.
Siri, Alexa. I mean, it's not perfect, but it's pretty good. And it wasn't like having a conversation with you know, your friend or your spouse, but
right.
it's an easier way of turning the music on than flipping a switch. So you change the paradigm for what the experience could be, and then you build into that paradigm.
Yeah, imagine, I mean, as long as we're finger painting, imagine a real estate agent, you know, who for years and years and years have been under attack, you know, for their, are they really earning their fees and mm-hmm. so on. And, you know, I think it's pretty clear Zillow's perhaps looking to take them on, and Redfin already has.
Right.
To some extent. And I've talked to a lot of people adjacent to the industry who think that's coming. But what if the real estate agent is allowing you to build your aesthetic preference model and making that available to you and doing a bunch of other really advanced things as services that they can provide you mm-hmm. in addition to their skills within a specific market? That could be really interesting.
Kind of like how you described, if you're looking for a home, the advantage of AI is artificial intelligence is that each of us would have our own algorithm, and right. that you're thinking that the real estate agent could be part of the process of building that algorithm.
Right. Yep.
So now we've talked about a little around the history of artificial intelligence, how we got here, some examples of how it's affecting us today, even the impacts of future regulation or the lack of regulation right now and what we're expecting to see. Where do we go from here? What's next in AI? Any predictions there?
It's going to become more and more ubiquitous. I think the focus is going to shift to security, safety, and legislation. I think the technology is outrunning all of that. That would be my thoughts. Though I do think, to narrow it a bit maybe, mm-hmm. I think human augmentation. A little tortured.
What's human augmentation?
Well, just helping a human make decisions, providing
okay. Oh,
them,
okay, got it.
Allowing them to use the strength of their context to arrive at better decisions. I think that'll be really interesting rather than just simply replacing humans. Some jobs will go away. You know, I've seen numbers, and it's hard to fathom this, that auto driving, self-driving vehicles will eliminate 15 million jobs in the U.S., in the U.S. alone. So what does that mean? Some will go away. You know, people that do type in data, right? OCR is eventually going to
yeah.
be good enough, and those jobs will go away, but there'll be something else, right? They'll be able to do higher order tasks.
I think I saw a date of 2025. And the definition of what will be possible by 2025 is the notion that if you ask a question to a machine, or if I ask that same question to Rob and they're behind a wall, I can't tell which one is the machine.
It's the Turing mm-hmm. test.
Turing test. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And they predict that by 2025, that will be the point of completion for the Turing test to pass.
Yeah, mark me as skeptical. So let me say that. I think in a narrow sense, the compute power might be there, but the human brain is really pretty phenomenal in its ability to make associations and be creative. You know, it may very well be that what AI does is allow us to unlock that creative potential over time, that help us bring these patterns out, and then we can make the free associations that we're so good at to innovate. That could be a really interesting space.
What are the implications of passing the Turing test?
I mean, it's, you could argue that it's self-aware. I mean, that's the notion of it. It would have to have computers respond to inputs and outputs.
Mm-hmm.
Do we allow it to define the outputs and stop giving it inputs and let it just pick its inputs? What direction would it go in? This is where
Musk and others.
This is where a lot of people are very afraid and scared of.
We take the guardrails off a bit.
It will evolve so fast, and mm-hmm. that what gets interesting is, you know, we're making the problems easier and easier to approach. through the cloud and these tools that are now available at a pretty high order level. At what point does you just tell it the problem, and then it can go find all the data, do all the work, all on its own, and then produce results against a problem that you've presented it, and you really are not part of the solution path at all? That's where people start getting a little nervous. That's not potentially as data gets more and more interconnected and more mm-hmm. and more available. That's maybe not that far off.
But if you look at the glass as half empty, you can ask it a problem like, why does this patient have cancer? And it can look at the blood type, genome sequencing, look at their hereditary lines of that person, and basically tell a doctor in near real time why the person has cancer and how to treat it.
Mm-hmm.
You can look at for meaningful ways of solving climate change. There are a lot of good things that can be done if we can control or limit the scope.
I agree. I'd double down on the health one. That's the one that I think is most interesting to me. So today your health information is very fragmented. Yep. It's in a doctor's office. It's on paper. Some of them have digital systems.
But that
there will be a move
yeah.
that it's your data. You will control it. Anytime a doctor collects data, including his diagnosis, it will go into a central repository in the cloud that you control with all the requisite security. And that when you go in, you'll give somebody keys to sections that are appropriate to whatever they're doing. But you could also, once it's all there, you can start doing really interesting analysis on the aggregate for things like cancer.
That already exists. Enigma.
But the problem is everybody's data isn't there. I don't have in the U.S. 330 million people, or I don't have all of Europe part of it,
nope.
or all of everybody.
That comes back to what I'm saying. Like, the power of AI is going to be the power of the ability to share data. Healthcare is probably the most premium example of where that use case either is fully supported or falls apart on the vine, because you can't get access to all that data. So you don't have the power because of the restrictions like HIPAA imposes, like GDPR.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, look at the 23andMe, for example, who's doing...
What's that?
Genetic testing.
Genetic. Well,
genetic
they start
mapping.
With your ancestry kind of stuff. It's like Ancestry.com,
yeah.
but they're a little... Everybody's got their nuance. They're collecting data, and there's two things you can do. You can get your ancestry, my people come from wherever, and in these percentages. And you also get... an analysis of your genetics for predispositions to certain things, like do I sneeze when I look in bright lights? Can I curl my tongue? A bunch of sort of semi-irrelevant markers. But there are also some things that are pretty interesting. And that's really, I think, what they're trying to do is get everybody comes in to find out, where my people are from. But then they ask you a bunch of survey questions like, how do you sleep, and take this cognitive test, and we're going to ask you against it 6 months, and is there Alzheimer's in your family, and all these things that they're now mapping against your genome. And you get enough people in here, and now they start to get really interesting data. Now, the FDA is sort of getting involved in it and made them pull back some tests that they couldn't tell you, and they're rolling them back out, and you sign a disclosure or click on it and say, I agree, and I'll tell you whether you are susceptible to this rare form of cancer or whatever.
Right.
But think of how that's going to keep progressing and how it could get really interesting once I get millions, hundreds of millions, billions of people's health
right.
data and their genomes in a place where I have compute power that's almost unlimited. And I can look at it longitudinally and geographically, for environmental clusters that are, that are real, because I can see their genome now and know that, wow, this wasn't a statistical oddity, that this is really
mm-hmm.
outside the bounds of.
And that's a good point. So I think the major impact will not be in the reactive nature that is healthcare, like how do I treat it? It's going to be more in the preventative or
right.
predictive. Like, this is what I forecast.
And so these are the steps you need to take.
Well, it's not that, though. I mean, I think it's It is that, absolutely. Right. It's, but I'm saying if you just look at the property industry, look at the mortgage industry, there's some applications that AI can help better inform the next decision. So that's the reactive way of looking at it. But ultimately, it's to capture a decision in flight and change that decision for the better.
Right. And there are infinite examples and so many great things and exciting things to come with artificial intelligence. And I really appreciate both of you taking the time to dive into this topic and provide, one, some education about it, but also, you know, a bit more insight into how it's already affecting our lives and potentially how it's going to. So thank you, Aaron, and thank you, Rob, for joining today.
Thank you, Amanda.
Thank you for having us.
The views expressed during this podcast are those of the individual and do not necessarily reflect the position of CoreLogic or its management. If you're interested in learning more about CoreLogic's Innovation in Housing podcast, please visit our website, www.corelogic.com/insights.